Hello, my name is Hamlet Dobbins, and this is Memphis Material, an oral history project chronicling the stories of the visual arts in Memphis, Tennessee. Memphis Material is a podcast celebrating the personal histories and the intimate stories and the studio practices of some of the people who help shape the creative landscape of our city. These unedited interviews are all recorded at the Memphis Listening Lab, a gem of an archive located in the majestic Crosstown Concourse in Midtown. The Memphis Material website and archive were designed by the wonderful Brian Dixon. Now, we don't have sponsors for these podcasts, but if we did, today's very short but awesome interview with Derek Fojor is sponsored by Central High School and Bill Hicks. So this summer, I have not been as regular about publishing these interviews because I have been teaching with the CAM kids. And so I've been doing this 5-week intensive painting program where it's Monday through Friday from 9 to 4. And I know normal people work those hours, but this has been particularly intense. And so after the summer's over, there'll be more podcast released. But one of the cool things about being at CAM was that I got to run into Derek Fojor. And I think one of the ways I was able to sweet talk him into coming in to talk to me today was to talk about Bill Hicks and the impact that he had on his practice. Let's see. So today is Saturday, June 13th. Derek just left. But here is the interview that I did with Derek Fojor. Usually we start with, you know, what's your earliest memory of art?
Sure.
But really, what I would love to do, since you're here and you are such a student of Bill Hicks's, and Bill is also one of those people that we had just have not been able to have in.
Yeah.
But we have had lots of his students in.
Yeah.
And so I'm super curious, like, thinking about Bill, so that was at Central High School.
That was at Central. I just wanted to show you this, Alexis. Just to,
oh, great.
It's like from minutes ago.
Nice, nice.
Yeah.
And if I remember right, you're maybe 4 years younger than me. I graduated from high school in 88.
88, yep. I was 92.
Okay. And so that would have been sort of a similar time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was your art world like before being at Central, being with Bill?
So I was a kid that couldn't stop drawing things, and I would kind of notoriously draw during church, and I would draw other church members, little girls I had crushes on, you know, just sort of always active. Fortunately, my parents never stopped me, and the church just sort of embraced me, and I think I found my first maybe mentor at the church, a woman named Shirley Sherman, who's still around. Shirley was a graphics designer back when graphics designers, you know, worked analog, right?
Right, with
tape and pen and ink.
Yeah.
And, so that was a very tactile world to see. And she took me under her arms, and I started to get little jobs at church doing bulletins, programs. And she told my parents I had something. And so I would just do, you know, backdrops at church. I mean, at this time, I'm 10, 11 years old. I was super young. But with all that support, I was just like clearly artistically talented. But there was no path to life as an artist with a capital A until I entered Central. And I'm glad I can tell the story somewhere. You know, I was in the 10th grade, a very silly boy, and nothing in life was serious. And I was crushing on these girls who were seniors. And I don't know if you're, I mean, in high school, to be a 10th grader and to have the attention of seniors was just something special. So that's where my priorities were. And we were doing a contour drawing in Bill's class. And he called me into the hallway with my drawing board and broke my drawing board over his knee. And if you know him, he's a very chill person. It was the most violent thing I've ever seen him do. And he said, "I will not allow you to waste your talent on my watch." He called my parents that day, and he said, "Your son is supremely talented, and he needs to focus in art, and he can go places." And from that moment to moments before I came in here, we've had a unbreakable bond.
Now, what were you like in that class? And look, this is the very beginning of the class in 10th grade?
Yeah, I had been in there just a little bit, probably done a few assignments, and he had seen, you know, the glimmers of something. I remember it was a contour drawing assignment, and it was very easy for me. And I think at that age, I didn't understand that, you know, what you're good at or what comes easy still requires work. So I just didn't take it that seriously. I just, you know, I was just having fun. And but Bill, you know, from there in the 10th grade to the next 2 years, I mean, it was, you know, he paired me with other students. It was working after class. You know, I was actually interested in football at the time a little bit. And he was like, you need to choose. I mean, he really put me on the track and then started to show me what the world of an artist can look like. And he would go to New York and come back and say, Derek, I was just there. And I, you know, have these friends, you know, that drive convertibles down Madison Avenue, you know, and they're artists that only work, you know, 4 months out of the year. And he just started painting these pictures for me of, you know, life as a successful artist. He also would show you the best students from prior years. And that created this sort of, you know, goalpost for you.
And now, any of those stick out in your brain?
Oh, I know all of them. Adam Shaw. Seth Kelly was ahead of me. Seth Kelly is now a partner at Petzl Gallery that represents me in New York. You know, Corin Jones, who's actually an artist in residence now at Crosstown at this moment. All of those guys were ahead of me. Reed Chapel, another one who Reed's dad is an illustrator, a Memphis artist. Reed was incredibly talented, so I still remember those names, and they absolutely inspired me.
Now, when Bill would show you these things, I mean, just out of curiosity, I mean, I am a teacher too, mm-hmm. and so I know when we break out, you know, the PowerPoints, and, mm-hmm. and we, you know, of course, back
this
in the
pre-PowerPoint.
It was the slide carousel.
Right.
And so, like, I know when we would normally pull out the slide carousel, it would put the students right to bed, and you knew that you only had, I as a teacher, especially thinking about high school kids, would have about 15 minutes to be able to do it. And,
yeah.
And what was that like in terms of the way he was showing you these things?
That's a great question. You're obviously an educator to know that. He would actually have original works of art from these artists up and around.
Oh, wow.
So I think for Bill, you know, to give work attention and then to give it real estate, you know, in the classroom, was, you know, kind of, you know, high honor. And so he would just have, you know, like one of Seth's great artworks or Reed or Adam, and he would rave about it and it would be up and it would actually be amazing, you know. So it wasn't, you know, he wasn't convincing us of something. It was great work.
Right.
And so it would just live around the classroom.
Now, what was it about the work that was good?
So another thing I appreciated about Bill was that the objectives were very clear. We were working observationally, and so very often working, you know, from still life. That was a lot of what was happening, still life, self-portraiture. And Bill really wanted you to allow the brushwork, to allow paint to be paint, which sounds very simple. But to anyone who's ever made a painting, and what I see with young artists is a desire to sort of overdetermine the, you know, the mark, the painted mark, and to make it, you know, behave like, you know, something more graphic or a drawing tool. And Bill wanted you to be free and to let the bravura of the brushstroke, you know, sort of go down wet paint into wet paint. He showed us John Singer Sargent, also Bay Area figurative painters, David Park, Richard Diebenkorn. These are guys I still, you know, look up to this day because I sort of learned how to paint.
Now, Park and Diebenkorn did not come into my world until I was grown up, until I was mature and I sort of knew what was going on. I can only imagine what the 10th grade Hamlet would have thought about that work. Did it strike you at the time? I mean, aside from it having the cachet of being with Mr. Hicks?
Yeah, I didn't know anything about where they stood in the art world. I really didn't have a sense of the greater art world. I just knew and was obsessed with technical competency and of having a kind of dexterity and control and to be able to make an image that had a certain kind of gravitas, a kind of sophistication. And that was very difficult for me early on. And it was looking at those works to understand the kind of poetics of a painting, or how to build intrigue, or the uncanny and how these things function, you know, within the painting.
Now, were you looking at, thinking about Diebenkorn, he is someone who is a big hero of mine.
Yeah.
When you were thinking about Diebenkorn, one of the things that would blow my mind when I first started looking at his work was the breadth, you know,
yes.
going from the really early things mm-hmm. and then the figurative pieces
yep.
and then the late pieces.
Yep.
I mean, was all of that a part of the allure as well?
You know, That's a great point. You know, for me with Diebenkorn, I think it was that vacillation between, you know, the observational, the figurative, and abstraction. You know, thinking about the landscapes, the cityscapes from San Francisco. I still remember there's a painting of Diebenkorn's that has a table on which there's a pair of scissors and maybe a tomato, you know, and just to see how that sort of editing, you know, and the sparse, you know, composition with all of the activity of the brushwork could hold your gaze, and that could hold space. I mean, learning that kind of sophistication as a, 16-year-old was a real jump. You know, and we're looking at images. I mean, I'm not looking even at original artworks.
Right.
We're looking at, reproduction. So I think it was just about learning and appreciating how to make a painting compelling mm-hmm. without being overly stylistic or some of the tendencies that, you know, as a young artist you might go to. And I think looking at works that were so, so sophisticated was a wonderful, foray into how to build a painting.
And you guys were working with oil.
We were working with oil. There was no, acrylic was sort of like a lesser medium in our minds,
right.
At that time. And this is pre-terpenoid even.
I was going to say, that room must have been terribly stinky.
Yeah. I wonder what we worked with in the classroom, now that you say that. Yeah, but I don't remember working in acrylics. Everything was oil.
Mm.
Yeah,
and then also like with Diebenkorn, so much of his images for me are about the building. About the constructing of the image and,
yes.
and the physicality, the sexiness,
mm-hmm.
the physicality of the paint and how it goes down,
mm-hmm.
brittle, dry, squishy, mushy. All that
mm-hmm.
to me is really rich. And then you were saying John Singer Sargent as well.
Yeah,
those people, obviously, there's some people in both all of those paintings, but
mm-hmm.
what was it about Sargent? P.S. I know it's a dopey question, but Sargent,
it's not dopey.
Sargent hits different people for different reasons.
It's not dopey. I'm a lifelong Sargent enthusiast. It's a very fair question. There were two things that happened with Sargent. I think another guy to mention, there's Elmer Bischoff also, mm-hmm. and, more than Diebenkorn for me, it became Wayne Thiebault. Who I ended up writing, he was one of the artists I referenced in my thesis as a master's student. For me, I think, for Sargent, being able to memorialize these lives and to give great import to these sitters was something. And maybe that was starting to become the bridge towards representation for me. And at this time, we're talking 1992, we're talking 1991, 1990. So this idea of, a black aesthetic, black figurative painting, which is very commonplace, I think, today, that conversation had not begun. And I think in Memphis, it was George Hunt, who was, very active in those years. Brenda Joy Smith was downtown and her husband came from New York, and they were, I'm just thinking about sort of like figuration of black figuration. It just really wasn't there. So looking at John Singer Sargent and knowing that I could feel the prominence of the figures just by really how luxurious he painted, but also what accoutrement artifacts that he assembled around them, what they wore, learning this kind of, you know, encoding that is pulled from everyday life that could communicate status, I think that, you know, approach to, you know, picture making and representation started to open doors in my mind about what was possible around, you know, representing figures in my world.
Now, was that something that, that Bill Hicks really sort of pushed, this idea of figuration?
Yes, about figuration.
Most of the people that you mentioned, I mean, I knew a couple of those names, pretty figurative, and then I know some other former students of his that, you know, really have an affinity for the figure.
I would say figuration and observational figure drawing, you know, still life, you know, some landscape. I mean, he was really kind of old school, you know, atelier approach to learning how to paint.
And this was, again, this was in high school. And so the thing that blows my mind about high school, I don't know what it was then, but now I think the classes meet for 50 minutes, 50 minutes. Yeah. And I don't know how you can do anything in 50 minutes.
Yeah, well, we spent a lot more time with Bill than that. It was all about after school, you know, so we would be there no less than 2 or 3 hours. And then he would pair you with other students. A guy I got paired with was a guy named Paul Rice, who is my brother, and I love and adore him. He's from Mumford, Tennessee. We met when I was, maybe we were probably 15 or 16, and he's a long-haired white boy that drove a Volkswagen bus, loved the Grateful Dead. We couldn't have been sort of more different in terms of where we came from. And Paul had transferred from Mumford High and wanted to learn how to paint. And he said, you two belong together. And when I tell you, we've had an uninterrupted kind of love fest since that time. He's the guy who really, there's no title for him. We call him kind of art director for my shows. So all my installations, when you see these elaborate build outs, it's Paul Rice. And so our relationship was forged at, you know, 15 and 16 learning how to paint together. So it wasn't just a classroom. It was us going down to Paul's father's warehouse. His father did all the floats for the parades in Memphis. And so he had, you know, before Harbor Town was a thing and all of that, he had a big warehouse. And we would go in there and do nude paintings of one another. And my brothers, I have two brothers that still joke me and Paul to this day about riding around in that damn bus and getting naked in front of each other. They don't see Paul without cracking those jokes. But we learned how to paint from the figure, painting live. And, you know, I would model, he would model, we would paint. We were really serious. And so it was all those hours.
Now, was it just the two of you, or was it just because Bill Hicks had paired you guys up? Was there a cadre, a cohort of others?
There definitely were. So it was Paul and I were alone sometimes, but then we had Stephanie Pierce, who's another, do you know Stephanie? Yeah. She's an incredible painter. She heads the department at FIT in New York now. A very smart, impassioned, gifted painter. And, you know, it was really kind of the three of us. We had another friend, Jess Britton. And I think Stephanie had a place on her own at that time. So we would do sessions, you know. So we would all get together. Ashley Thayer was another one. I think she was a year behind us. Ashley would, you know, we would all just sort of get together and paint. So it was just this band of freaks, you know, who would, you know, roam around in Midtown and organize ourselves around painting and drawing.
Now, what kind of things would you guys talk about? I mean, part of my brain is wondering, like, what do young high school kids talk about when they talk about art? Because I didn't have any of that.
I think we were obsessed with getting good and making good work. I don't even remember the substance of conversations. I don't think we were very deep that way. I think Bill was the arbiter of what was good, what was not, and you were trying to make more good than not. And that was it. And I think that, you know, as you have me reflecting on it, I think the simplicity of that mission. And it's like, you know, I hate to use a, you know, sporting analogy, but it's sort of like, you know, you're trying to win games. You know, it's like there are a lot of, you know, techniques and that kind of thing. But like, I mean, to make a great painting is just not easy. And I think learning how to do that was our obsession.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, too, I mean, I know we all have sort of different relationships with our teachers, and of course the relationship between, you know, a young artist and their art teacher is a really powerful one. Mm-hmm. But I wonder, what was it about Bill and his teaching that made him such a figure, not just for you, but for hundreds of other kids?
That's a great question. I think Bill's personality, he was funny. He was very idiosyncratic. His classroom was his domain. He was not heavy-handed. For me, he was a relief from, you know, the kinds of relationships I had with adults, which were very, you know, maybe paternalistic, or, you know, you were, you know, this kind of lower being in many ways. Bill really treated you like a full human, a full adult. You were capable of many things. He respected your opinion. But he was just sort of no nonsense. He knew art. He was someone that knew what he knew. He was passionate about it. He was democratic. You know, I was a black kid, you know, in art in the early 90s, which was, you know, kind of like mostly the white kids. And this is relevant if you know anything about, you know, Memphis going back in time, and the further back you go, the more segregated spaces were, you know, socially. And, you know, Bill really didn't care about any of that. I mean, he was really committed to talent. And even when I work with young people today, I have that same insistence among, you know, relative to talent. It really doesn't matter to me where you come from. I mean, that you have a gift and that you have a passion and you want to get good at that, that's pretty much all that matters to me. And I really got that from Bill. And I appreciated that whatever difference there existed between all of us, and we were very different, all of us, what bonded us together was our passion for art.
Hmm. Now, what about, I mean, you were talking about the segregated classroom. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my brain, Central has always been a particularly diverse school. Was the art room that way, or were you sort of the only black kid hanging out in there?
For the time I was there, and that, you know, I think the story of Central is over time became increasingly more diverse. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and I know this because my older brother was there 4 years before me, and my younger brother was there 4 years after me. Okay. So we can sort of track the demographics of the school.
Yeah.
And so at the moment that I was there, art, you know, I was the only black kid. You know, there might have been other folks kind of that dabbled in and out, but in terms of that core that was obsessed, that Bill was like, you're gonna get this, you know. You know, it was me. There might be other people. It's been 30 years. I don't want to, you know, I do remember Keith was another friend. There were people in and out, but maybe I just see things now through the prism of my friendships. Mm-hmm. And in that friendship group, you know, it was me, but it never even mattered. Mm-hmm. And we were really, you know, they're to this day, they're like siblings to me. And it really was about painting, drawing, whether we were doing monotypes or, you know, learning a little printmaking. Bill would, you know, get a press and be so excited that he had a press, and he would, you know, teach us, you know, a little bit of dry point or, you know, and so we were just art geeks.
See, we had ebony pencils, and I was like, man, yeah, these pencils are awesome. They're so much better than regular pencils. And that was like the extent. So when you're talking about monotypes, uh-huh, and everything else, I'm just like, oh my God, that place must have been amazing.
Well, you know, when you speak about ebony pencils, I can't not mention another mentor that came into my life a little later. My older brother introduced me to one of his fraternity brothers, a guy named Frank D. Robinson.
Okay.
And Frank D. was really kind of a graphic designer, and Frank made art with ebony pencils, and he made these works that blew my mind. I still have many of them, and I had a period where I was obsessed with ebony pencil. And this was when I was, you know, kind of a freshman in college. It took me quite a bit to get a degree, but somewhere in that college space, I became obsessed with ebony pencils.
Now, how did you know Frank?
It was my brother. My older brother was just like, you got to meet Frank, you know. And he introduced me to Frank. He literally took me over one day and was like, you need to meet Frank D. And, you know, I went to the frat house. I ended up joining that fraternity years later, but I went to the frat house, and Frank was there drawing with, you know, all his, you know, pads and pencils in his lap. And he's like, Ford Jordan, it's your little brother? I'm like, yeah. And he's like, let me see what you got. And it's like a movie scene, you know. I like, scramble to produce my, like, you know, my little book. And he's like, he like looks over it, you know, nodding his head page to page, saying nothing, saying nothing, saying nothing. Gets to the last page and he goes, all right, he got something. And from that moment, Frank kept me at his knee. And I learned how to do a little graphic design. I learned how to draw. I learned how to kind of sell things. We would make little, you know, I was his tag along. And Frank had this Frank D. Originals. There are people of, you know, a certain age that would know Frank D. from that period. And Frank is the one who then introduced me to George Hunt. And George Hunt was running a program out of Carver in the summer for underprivileged kids at that time, is the language we used. And so I really didn't qualify. You know, my father was a physician, and but they found a way to get me in that program. And again, these are moments that shape the way I approach, you know, program building. You know, I really recognize that I don't want to create a program that keeps anybody out. You know, and if they hadn't given me that exception, I would have missed all those days with those guys. But I was, you know, going to a summer program at Carver High School and making art all day, you know, with George Hunt and Frank D.
Now tell me about Mr. Hunt, because I met him a handful of times. I remember when he had a show at the Memphis Center for Contemporary Art.
Yep.
And I remember talking to him really briefly then. Mm-hmm. But I know that he is another figure that looms really large. P.S., you are killing me, dropping all of these names, and my brain is like, Derek, I'm going to lock this door, and I'm not going to let you out, because we have to talk about Wayne Thiebaud.
That's
we
right.
have to talk about Bischoff.
That's
now
right.
Now we have to talk about Frank D.
Yes.
Now we have to talk about... But George Hunt.
That's right.
Well, talk to me a little bit. I mean, P.S., we are not even done talking about Bill Hicks. I have lots of questions about Bill Hicks.
Sure.
But talk to me about George Hunt, since he's on your brain right now.
Yeah, George was really a guy who had a kind of successful career locally. It just seemed like he was just this kind of outlier. And I would see his work kind of everywhere. Bill Street Festival posters, Memphis in May. He had shows. You know, and he had fans. People, you know, knew his work, loved his work. And he was a plain spoken kind of country guy, and I say that affectionately. And so why that's relevant is that he would simplify things for you in these kind of pithy homespun truisms. And that's really refreshing in the space of art that can be really intimidating and complicated. You don't remember a lot of stuff. And so he was like hanging out with an old blues musician. And you learned how important it was to work. And I remember, you know, Coach Hunt was, you know, former athlete. He was kind of this brawny guy. It'd be so hot in there in Carver, and, you know, in the summertime, no air conditioning. I remember him, you know, this kind of brolic, muscular guy with his shirt off, you know, dripping in sweat, like making those paintings. And I remember how physical the act of painting was and how committed he was. And there was almost something kind of, you know, admirable and tough and, you know, and he wasn't, you know, an overly, you know, he didn't perform masculinity, but he was a impressionable figure to me at a time when I was trying to determine what kind of artist I wanted to be, what kind of man I wanted to be, and seeing, you know, Coach Hunt kind of running his business and making space for me and other Frank and guys much younger than him, it became a kind of model for the life of a painter, what it could look like.
Mm-hmm. And George Hunt was one of those people that, as a person who was a civilian, you would actually see his work. Like, it would just be around town, or it would be not necessarily in big murals or anything, but because we didn't have those at the time, but you know, on posters.
Yeah.
And I definitely remember seeing his work sort of all around.
Yep.
And then you also mentioned Brenda Joy Smith and Robert Bain.
Yeah.
I want to talk about them too.
Yeah.
All right, I'm gonna hold it down.
And Ephraim Urefubu, who was across the street,
who was
very close to my aunt, my auntie Dora. They had a friendship when Ephraim came from Nigeria and was kind of sleeping on a park bench or something. This is a folklore. She met him in that time where he was just this kind of ambitious guy who landed in Memphis and wanted to make something of himself. And I watched him build, you know, his gallery also on Main Street before it was a thing. And Ephraim also helped me. So I just really had all these folks, you know, that were helping in big and small ways, you know, just, you know, kind of holding me. And this is why I have such a deep affection for Memphis. It was a cradle for my development.
Now, thinking about George Hunt, I mean, one of the things that I also remember about his work was that it was really meaty. You know, it was real thick, and there was a lot of, like, buildup and a lot of erasure and a lot of finding
and in texture. The image.
Yeah. Tell me some more things that you remember about, because he's another person that I wish that we could have talked to.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit more about your experiences with George.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny you remind me that he's gone as I'm speaking. He's so alive, but you know, rest in peace to him and his son Kylan, who was also a very good friend of mine. I think it was the man for me even more than the work. There were moments in Coach Hunt's work. There were moments in his paintings when it just all worked and felt right. I can't say every single moment that I saw was something I wanted to emulate. As I remember, it's the man that had that impact on me, who he was, how grounded he was, and how committed he was to the development of young people. He also occupied both spaces. Again, I mean, I hate to sound like I was, you know, born, you know, 60 years ago, but at that time, the arts really were pretty segmented. You know, luckily you're nodding, you know this too. And he really traversed both worlds. He was sort of out east, Germantown, South Memphis. So those kind of divides that existed in the city, I saw his agency in the way he was able to move, and I admired that. And it was something that you know, I think I aspired to.
Now tell me more about this cohort. Was it a group of people that would meet at Carver?
Yeah, it was a program. It was a summer program, just sort of like summer youth, you know. Most of the kids weren't, you know, obsessed with art, but he was running an art summer art program. I didn't really bond so much with the other kids because I was always in Coach Hunt's shadow. So he sort of was like, you come back here and, like, sit over there. And, you know, I would just be lost in making these, you know, large ebony pencil drawings. They just kept me, like, locked in. Him and Frank just had me, like, I get their report for duty and I'm making art for whatever, 6 hours, and then do it again the next day. You know, what I think I appreciate is the commitment to work, you know, that it really, I wouldn't say there's no magic, but magic happens in the working. And I think I got that lesson, you know, from being around those guys. You know, Frank was always working. Oh, I never saw Frank D when he wasn't working, and it's what he talked about. And I think learning how obsessed you could be gave me license. And that was what was consistent with, you know, Frank D, what was consistent with Coach Crawford, Robert Crawford, what was consistent with George Hunt, what was consistent with Bill Hicks, is that to be an artist, these guys were always active. And I think that sort of set the stage, and it really made things very simple about how to go after it, you know?
And if I remember right, my very brief conversation with George Hunt, it was really sort of like this evangelist moment. Like, mm-hmm. he was really sort of, not preaching, but it mm-hmm. was like, yeah, and then you should also think about this, and then mm-hmm. that other person, and if you like these, you should really look at this.
Right.
And I remember it was kind of this, like, a desire to share, you know.
Yes.
Was that something that was also really sort of, I mean, obviously that's something that we think about when we're thinking about you and your connection to the city.
Mm-hmm.
But was that also present with your relationship with George?
I was just so, yes, it was. But I was just so grateful. You know, at that time I wasn't thinking about, you know, what I might do. I think as an artist, I just was so happy to be around other artists. You know, these are people that did it, you know, full time. This is what they did. And, you know, again, this is, you know, I wasn't in New York, you know, I wasn't, you know, in LA even, like, you know, in Memphis, you know, as a young person, you're looking for models. And I think I was just so grateful that not only did he exist, but he made space for me and made me feel you know, powerful and made me feel valuable. And what I was doing was, you know, unique and not something to, you know, disregard.
And he was an older, I mean, when I met him, he was an older man, mm-hmm. and was, you know, obviously really good at what he did, but also, you know, most of our heroes when we're young are like, you know, people who died really young, and to see someone who is mature still doing it and still being really great and still being really impactful, I mean, mm-hmm. that was really important, I'm sure. Now, thinking about making work, you mentioned Bill a lot in terms of his teaching. Mm-hmm. I don't think I know what kinds of things. I think I saw a piece of his. Maybe in the Brooks show.
Yes, the MCA show.
There's a piece of his.
Yeah, I think the Memphis College of Art did include his work.
Okay.
You know, it is true that Bill is probably more of an educator than an exhibiting artist. He definitely had moments when he showed his work, but I think a lot of his work was closely held, and he was, you know, really masterful in terms of, you know, painting and drawing. But I think he was also shy, and I think he was also more committed to pushing his students than he was chasing for himself a career. You know, today I was just with him, and we were talking about his pursuit of a low MFA, and I remember when he was working as a MFA student at MICA while he was teaching. I remember him, you know, taking his trips up there, that kind of thing. So I do remember moments when he was probably making more of a push, you know, to, you know, show his work through galleries and that kind of thing. But I think in the final analysis, most of his energy was spent educating artists.
Mm-hmm. But also, I mean, when we're in high school, we don't know the art world.
We don't know.
You know, we just know, like, whoa, this dude just showed us this thing.
Right.
Were there things that you remembered in particular about when you saw his work?
Oh, sure. I mean, I have a painting of his, and I begged him for it. There are so many moments. I mean, he made these gorgeous monotypes where we would just, you know, put ink on a plexiglass plate, and I think the monotypes are really instructive because you could see his relationship to mark making stripped down from, you know, color, texture, and the rest of it. It's just sort of wiping and, you know, a brush on a, you know, on a slick surface. And I learned a lot from, you know, the virtuosity of, you know, his mark making from his monotypes. He also made gorgeous paintings, you know, that were, you know, large scale, sometimes, you know, portraits of people that he would paint. Sometimes he would do plein air paintings, and the way he would translate, you know, foliage and, you know, maybe just a canoe in the grass. And so I do remember, I do have, you know, an index in my mind of, you know, Bill Hicks' works. And I could discuss these with, you know, my mates who also remember things that were impressionable in them. I wouldn't say, and I think to his credit and to every great educator, and I hope it's true about you too, I don't think Bill was fixated on teaching us to paint like him. Mm-hmm. I do think he wanted to expose you to the principles of, you know, good painting, but then he gave enough room for you to be yourself. And I say that knowing the varying styles of, you know, mark making that everyone brought to bear, and for each one of us, it was our own voice that he was going for.
And I'm curious, like, thinking about that development of the of your voice, mm-hmm. what kinds of things were you thinking about at the time? I mean,
I had nothing in terms of concept. That was all technique, you know.
Right, but what kind of things were you looking at? What kind of things were you drawing? What kind of things held your attention?
You know, I did, speaking about Memphis, I did enter the NAACP EXO competition, and I think EXO was an acronym for art, science, technology, you know, something. But it was put on by the NAACP, and it was a local, regional, and national competition. And they had a painting section, and you would, you know, enter, you know, painting, try to win for Memphis. There would be an exhibition. These weren't always, you know, sort of like all the art people, you know, but it was like, you know, people that had some proficiency in art would come around, adults. And so I won, you know, the city, and then I won the regional, and then I went to the state where you're competing with 49 other artists as a high schooler. And I won that 2 years in a row. And I think the artwork that I won with were probably my most successful attempts at any kind of meaning in a painting. But it was very much, you know, this means this, this means that, you know, kind of 1-2, 1-2 to build symbolism. But, you know, look, I was trying to figure it out, you know, and I think for, you know, the first 20 years of my adult life, I probably just had technical proficiency. And I think the mature artist that I, you know, eventually became was someone who finally found a way to marry the things I was passionate about and curious about with this obsession around technical fluency.
Now, when you were talking about being there in 10th grade, flirting with the girls, Bill getting mad, what kind of a kid were you? How did art fit into your world?
I was a funny kid. I am a middle child. I'm a quintessential middle child. My older brother is a lobbyist, and my younger brother is a dentist. You know, as I said, my father was a physician, so I was kind of the clown among straight men. You know, these guys were all pretty straight laced and loved wearing suits and ties. And, you know, I was kind of irascible, irreverent. You know, I was a little bit of a rabble rouser, rebel without a cause. So all the kind of typical black sheep, you know, isms, I kind of lived them all.
Now, were you kind of a cool kid? I mean, because
for
me,
I was cool enough. I'd say I was cool enough, but, you know, I've always done well at socializing, but probably am a very private person and enjoy being alone more than anything. And so I always, you know, kind of fluctuated between those worlds. I never loved like hanging out at parties and stuff. You know, that was never my thing. I enjoyed people, but, you know, in doses, that's probably always been true. So yeah, I dropped out of a bunch of colleges. It took me 9 years to get a bachelor's degree. You know, I got in trouble, you know, here and there. And
I mean, one of the reasons I'm asking and thinking about how, for me, the art room really was sort of a solace. You know, it was a place where, as this weird little kid, I wasn't made fun of, or, you know, I was sort of safe, in air quotes. But it was really because I was surrounded by other nerds, you know, like other people who were just bonkers about drawing or making art. Was that the way it was for you, or was that just another facet of your life?
I'd say it was another facet. You know, I was probably too cool, you know, and I think the art room is where I got in touch with the inner nerd, the maker. And I do see that refuge, you know, function that the art space can create. I think I had so much, you know, I probably was a bit too self-assured, and artists were a little fringy to me, you know, and I just thought I was a little cooler. I mean, we're talking about, you know, 15 years old. I thought I was just a little cooler, you know, than the artist. But I think I am an artist, and I was seduced into the lure of a world consumed with thinking about looking at making art. And I think it was just something I just could not refuse.
Now, I'm curious, what you mentioned the Bay Area folks and Singer Sargent. Mm-hmm. Were there other artists that grabbed your attention when you were a young whippersnapper?
I think, you know, we did have a lot of exposure through books, through art books, to lots of makers. I would say, you know, it was mostly at Bill's leadership that, you know, so it was all the things that he loved, you know, and of course, you know, the Manets and Monets and all the Impressionists and, you know, America Sot and Kata Kalowitz, and, you know, there were many artists that he exposed us to. But I think that's when I developed a love for, you know, the canon, and understanding that you're not working in isolation and that you're in dialogue with history and with present day makers. And I don't think it was anything very heady that he you know, taught us. I think his way of teaching us was through the works of other artists, and you develop an affection and an index in your mind that you can recall as you're working through different questions. And I think that that is very much still a central part of my practice.
Now, when you were there at Central, if I remember right, Bill at that time was also teaching AP art. Yep. Was it something that you took from 10th grade to all the way through?
It was the only thing I did good in. I mean, everything else was just like, I remember my family just like laughing at my report card. Like, this guy is not serious about life. Like, I just had A's in art and everything else was just like whatever. And it was my portfolio that got me to college. And I mean, I think I was even up for, you know, some scholarships that I couldn't get because my GPA was so laughable. But thankfully, the portfolio was decent. So my ticket was art. You know, I was a one-note samba most of my life.
Your memory is pretty great so far. Do you remember some of the things that were in the portfolio?
Yes. I mean, some moments, you know, I remember some moments where, you know, a little magic happened. And you know, yeah, I had a couple of moments. I think it's, you know, it's really about seeing that work. It's nothing I would care to, you know, describe, you know, but it was just mostly still life, you know, self-portraits, you know, nothing, you know, out of this world. I think it was just about a kid that had technical chops. I think that's what you could see from the portfolio.
No, I'm conscious of time, but I'm also conscious that you just got back from Bill's. And so like part of my brain is thinking, what is it about Bill that makes, you know, all these people that I really admire and respect so close with still? I mean, I think I just tracked down my high school art teacher on Facebook the other day, like for the first time. And so what do you think it is about Bill that makes him someone that everyone wants to sit with and visit with and talk with?
It's so good. Such a good question. I think Bill, in hindsight, was a friend. I think he really is a friend, and he doesn't sort of waste time. He doesn't need you to pander to his liking. He just needs you to take art seriously. It's a shared passion. It's what he's most excited about. And all of us are artists. And so we became artists, you know, under his tutelage. And I think that that's a special gift to give a young person, that you introduce them to a lifelong commitment and a lifelong obsession. So I think he transmitted his passion, and it's something we share. And because most of us still live a life chiefly concerned with art, that conversation with Bill remains, you know, open. And I think for most of us, it's a gratitude and a deep, deep, deep affection for him not just ending his regard for you at, you know, the bell at the end of the day. He really took you under his wing and cheered for you well after, you know, you were even a high school student. I mean, all the way on, Bill would cheer for you. He was telling me today about, you know, the students in his class who couldn't see and what stopped coming to class because he had an optometrist friend, and he would connect people, you know, to get them a pair of glasses, you know, so they could come to school. You know, he has a million of those little small acts. He was the most humble person. And for me, he was a model for living a decent, generous, respectful, creative life. And I am forever indebted to him for that.
If I have learned anything in this process, it is to find a good place to stop. And that was a perfect place to stop. Thank you for coming in, Derek. That was a treat. And that was the interview that I did with Derek Fojor. Also, at some point, we've got to get him back in here because he dropped way too many breadcrumbs, too many things that I want to talk about, and I feel like we barely scratched the surface. It's weird. I know most interviews are like an hour, but I honestly don't know how anybody does it. Anyway, so today is or the interview that was recorded that you just listened to is Saturday, June 13th. Please join us towards the end of the summer, maybe in July. We'll start releasing them again. Until then, thanks so much for listening.